Well, last time we talked about, we're beginning a new subunit on the need to use your mind. And so last time I talked about the nature of knowledge a little bit. We're going to get into a series on faith and reason, sort of as part of this subunit later on, and we'll dissect the nature of knowledge, belief, proof, and try to figure out how faith is a form of knowledge. But I introduced a threefold distinction that I think is very fruitful for understanding the nature of biblical knowledge. It's a distinction that philosophers use. You have propositional knowledge. You have operational knowledge. And then knowledge by acquaintance. And propositional knowledge is typically defined as knowledge that something is the case. Knowledge that Jesus rose from the dead. Knowledge that God is spirit and must be worshipped in spirit and in truth. Whenever you read the Bible, you're exposing yourself to propositional information, and that's propositional knowledge. Operational knowledge is knowledge how to do something. So if you know how to play an instrument, how to work on a car, you have a form of knowledge. It's a knowledge that is enabling you to perform in some way. It's operational knowledge, knowledge how. And unlike propositional knowledge, it cannot be learned just by reading an instruction manual. You actually have to practice what you are taught propositionally before you actually know operationally. So, for instance, some of you who play the instruments, pianos, violins like Ellie and other things, could perhaps give me a point-by-point description using propositions of how to play the piano or the violin. And I could read that, right? And I would have your propositional knowledge of how to play the violin. But would I automatically have your operational knowledge of how to play the violin? Absolutely not. Right? I would have to take your propositional knowledge, your direction, prescriptions, and I would have to transform them through practice into a different kind of knowledge, to where I could get up and I could play. That is a form of knowledge. And we're going to see that much of biblical knowledge is on that level. Then there's the knowledge of acquaintance, sometimes called the knowledge of something or someone, and that's a personal, direct encounter with the object. Having grown up in Southern California, I have acquaintance with San Diego. I could get online and I can read a description of San Diego, but that propositional knowledge, no matter how much detail it went into, would never become the same thing as knowledge by acquaintance. I use the example of Tim Feeney as a teacher. I sit in on one of his classes. He's a very skillful Socratic teacher, I believe. And I could write down this comprehensive description of him as a teacher. I could down to the detail of how he sits, inflection in his voice, little goofy jokes he makes, the amount of time he takes before he answers your question. Right? I could go into detail on that. But you would never know Tim Feeney as a teacher by acquaintance unless you were there. It's by actually being in the room with him, seeing him, hearing him, watching, you know, that's where you have a different kind of knowledge. It's knowledge by acquaintance. It's a direct encounter with the object known. If I read a book about Tokyo, I'm not having a direct encounter with the object known. I'd have to get up and go. This is also a form of biblical knowledge. Paul says that he wants to know Christ, that I may know Him. He's talking about acquaintance, dying with Christ, rising with Christ, fellowship with Christ Himself, not propositions about Christ per se, although that's part of what it involves, but an actual direct acquaintance. If you read through the New Testament with these distinctions in mind, you'll see they all show up explicitly. I read a number of passages last week where Paul talks about it's God's will for you to know how to possess your body as a vehicle through sanctification, to know how to respond to the unbeliever, to know how to do this, to know how to do that. But he also talks about knowing God intimately, personally. In 1 John, we're called into fellowship with God, to know Him. Not a bunch of propositions about Him, but to know Him directly through an acquaintance. And when you read, not only will you see these distinctions, you'll see them interwoven to where they just all hook together. They're all presupposed in one another. And you can't pry them apart. And it's an interesting fact because when you think about the state of the church, especially in America, where you have a very anti-intellectualist bent, a romantic spirit, an emotionalism, and so on, and then you have little pockets of intellectual Christianity, you see in those two extremes an inability to keep these things in balance, to keep them united. I used my own experience. When I became a Christian at the age of 20, I had a direct encounter with the risen Christ. It was a very powerful emotional experience to where I literally immediately lost all interest in pornography, cussing. My anger and bitterness just dissolved, just disappeared. It was this instant rebirth and transformation of my nature. It was radical, radical. And I became passionate about how to live out this new life in Christ, this operational knowledge. And I was in a very sort of emotional, experience-oriented Christian culture out in Southern California. And it was semi-charismatic. Some believed in speaking in tongues, but in any case, they were all very, very emotional in the way they thought about their experience with Christ. And for about a year, I would kind of go up and down on this emotional roller coaster. And I finally, by so many steps, realized I needed to know the Bible. And so my focus started turning here, and I left San Diego and I went to Maryland to a Bible college, and I started absorbing propositional knowledge. And I had a ravenous appetite for propositional knowledge to the point to where I was starting to read stuff that was extremely heavy, systematic theologies and Christian worldview type things. And in the process, over the several years that I was doing that, I lost sight of these two. And it was all about this. And I became extremely arrogant and contentious, cantankerous. I was an unpleasant person to be around. All I was concerned about was dotting your I's, crossing your T's. And I was joking with the guys last week that it's kind of like I had this Batman utility belt of arguments and ideas and definitions. And I could just, you know, I just saw myself as someone who's on the lookout for heresy and able to try to refute it. But the whole idea of coming out to Bible college to grow my knowledge of God and how to please Him, it just sort of disappeared. And I went through this long process of getting back to a more balanced understanding of what biblical knowledge is. And it's interesting, you have, even within our congregation, this specific congregation here in Pasadena, you have some people who, for whatever reason, we're going to try to explore some of these reasons later in the series, are not super keen on growing in their propositional knowledge of the Scriptures. And they don't have much of a hunger for it, whether it's their
They're not hungry, or they're intimidated, they're distracted, they don't understand the importance of it. There are people like that. There are others, again, in our own congregation, who overemphasize this and they're not focused on this. We all individually will experience with the tension to some degree, but there's certainly some who are going to err and do err on one side over against the other. But when you look at the New Testament, it's all together and it's maximized. We're going to look at a lot of texts over the next few weeks on this, but you're expected to grow in all three areas constantly, aggressively. And if we could learn to think about all three as essential components of knowledge, and that we're to grow in all three, it would make a big difference in our lives. Yes?
Hey, Brad, do you know to what extent that there are two or three different verbs used for know in the New Testament when they talk about these, or is it all just the same verb?
I've never looked at that. Gnosko is the most common. That's the noun form. I think is it epigenosko for the verb form? Probably the most common, but I'm not sure.
Epi is intensification.
Okay.
And depending who you read, some would say that's speaking more of the acquaintance. It's
yeah, right, 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 right.
But I don't know if that proves true across the board.
It's like every other language, but English will have at least a couple of verbs for now. We just lump it all into now and use a different word after it, maybe, to say what we're talking about.
Yeah, oftentimes the English translations will make it explicit if it's knowledge how, and I'm not sure what the different verbal forms would be. What I'd like to do today is get into this new outline on the mystery that's revealed to us. And what I'm going to do is set up a homework assignment for you. It's going to be an introduction to the biblical notion of mystery. And the goal for you over the next week will be to go into your concordance, look up the 27 uses of mystery in the New Testament. 21 are in Paul, a few are in the Gospels, and the rest in the book of Revelation. But go into those passages. You can just go into your concordance. Do all of you have a sort of an exhaustive or close to exhaustive concordance? If you don't, you can go online and look it up. Just type in mystery. And I think this is an important exercise to engage in, because part of getting a congregation and getting the church as a whole to grow in their knowledge of the Bible, of God revealed through Christ, is to give them a sense of zeal, excitement, hunger for it. And frankly, many of us don't experience that. And I'm talking about the church as a whole in America. And it's interesting when you think about how excited Paul and the New Testament congregations were. A lot of it had to do with the understanding that a mystery had been revealed. A mystery that had been kept secret ever since the beginning of time. It was now being revealed to them. And that prospect gave them a certain motive, an inducement to want to search, to understand, to grow in this mystery. And so the identity of the mystery is your homework assignment. To go through the text, figure out what is the mystery that's being revealed. But I'd like to give you some background here. First of all, there's a passage in 1 Peter, this is chapter 1, where he says, verses 8 to 12, "And though you have not seen Jesus, you love him. And though you do not see him now, but believe in him, you greatly rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, obtaining as the outcome of your faith the salvation of your souls. As to this salvation, the prophets who prophesied of the grace that would come to you made careful searches and inquiries, seeking to know what person or time the Spirit of Christ within them was indicating as he predicted the sufferings of Christ and the glories to follow. It was revealed to them that they were not serving themselves, but you, in these things which now have been announced to you through those who preach the gospel to you, sent from heaven, things into which angels long to look. He doesn't use the word mystery here, but that's the mystery that's being talked about. He's talking about the revelation of a mystery. The use of mystery, like I said, is fairly prominent, especially in Paul's epistles, and most importantly in the book of Ephesians. I think it occurs 6 or 7 times there. And in every case, the idea is that this mystery that's been revealed to us is something that's been hidden for a long, long, long time. And that's where the excitement comes. The prospect, the realization that it's been revealed to us now. In Romans 16, listen to some of this language. Verses 25 to 26. Paul says, "Now to him who is able to establish you according to my gospel and the preaching of Jesus Christ, according to the revelation of the mystery which has been kept secret through long ages, but now is revealed, and by the scriptures of the prophets, according to the commandment of the eternal God, is made known for obedience of faith to all the nations." 1 Corinthians 2. "Yet we do speak wisdom among those who are mature, a wisdom, however, not of this age, nor of the rulers of this age who are passing away, but we speak God's wisdom in a mystery, the hidden wisdom which God predestined before the ages to our glory. The wisdom which none of the rulers of this age has understood, for if they had understood, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. But just as it is written, things which eye has not seen and ear has not heard, and which have not entered the heart of men, all that God has prepared for those who love him." A similar passage in Ephesians. This is in chapter 1 and chapter 3. Paul says, "In all wisdom and insight, God made known to us the mystery of his will, according to his kind intention, which he purposed in him." Then later he says, "For this reason I, Paul, the prisoner of Jesus Christ, for the sake of you Gentiles, if indeed you have heard of the stewardship of God's grace, which was given to me for you, that by the revelation there was made known to me the mystery, as I wrote before in brief. By referring to this, when you read, you can understand my insight." Then lastly, Colossians 1. "Of this church I was made a minister according to the stewardship from God bestowed on me for your benefit, so that I might fully carry out the preaching of the word of God. That is, the mystery which has been hidden from the past ages and generations, but has now been manifested to his saints, to whom God willed to make known what is the riches of the glory of this mystery among the Gentiles." So you have all of this language of this mystery that has been kept secret and is now being revealed. This is the point, I think, that should get us so excited as members of the new covenant, that we have now been given access to it. The word for mystery is mysterion, and it comes from a Greek verb which means to close the mouth. The idea is that the content of the mystery is information, knowledge, truth that's kept private within the mind of someone. And it's only when they open their mouth, and the Greek word that's used there is apokalypsis, that from which we get apocalypse, revelation. It's only when they open their mouth that the information is given to us. So whoever has the information kept secret in his mind has control of who gets to know it. And until that person speaks it, you cannot discover it. Interesting fact. It's not like natural revelation. See, natural revelation, you can go out and look at it. It's public. But the revelation that comes from the person who harbors the mystery can only be gathered by their word when they speak it. And God did not speak it until the time of Christ. I want to talk about the Hebraic background of this mystery in Daniel, and then the Greco-Roman background and understand that God's working behind the scenes, both in the Jewish and in the Greco-Roman scenes, to prepare their minds for this mystery of Christ. In Daniel, it's the only other time that the word mysterion is used in the Old Testament, the Greek, the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Old Testament. It's the only other time it's used in Daniel. And it's used in chapter 2. Do you guys know what's in chapter 2? I'm sorry?
The image of the statue.
Yeah, the statue. Nebuchadnezzar gets this dream, and he's trying to get it figured out. And he can't get the insight until Daniel comes on. And we read this in chapter 2. He says, "Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision." And Daniel went on to bless God for revealing this to him. He says, "It is He who changes the times, He, God, who changes the times and the epochs, He who removes kings and establishes kings, He who gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. It is He who reveals the profound and the hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with Him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and power. Even you have made known to me what we request of you. For you have made known to us the king's matter." Then Daniel goes before the king and says, "As for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men, conjurers, magicians, nor diviners are able to declare it to the king. However, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and He has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days," the eschaton, the end times. "This was your dream and the vision in your mind while you were on your bed." And he goes on to explain it. He says, "As for you, O king, while on your bed, your thoughts turn to what would take place in the future. And He who reveals mysteries has made known to you what will take place. But as for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing in me more than in any other living man, but for the purpose of making the interpretation known to the king." And he explains the dream as a perception of the statue, right? The four kingdoms. You have Babylon, followed by Persia, then Greece, and then Rome. Then there's a fifth kingdom, of which he says, "In those days, in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed, and that kingdom will not be left for another. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever." So the one place where you have reference to this mystery is talking about the coming kingdom, the kingdom of God in Christ. And of course, the standard Jewish understanding of this was that it was going to be a political Messiah who would liberate Israel from Gentile domination and turn the tables and impose Jewish domination on the Gentiles. It would be the Solomonic era on steroids, where they're all streaming to Jerusalem for the wisdom of the Messiah and for His rule. So that's the Jewish background. There's a mystery that the Jews are looking into. As Peter said, the prophets were trying to understand it. The angels long to understand it. And they're looking, they're searching the Scriptures, trying to figure out, what is God going to do? But it's concealed. The most He reveals is that this Messiah will come. But the nature of His rule, the nature of the Messiah, the consequences, all of that is still sort of cryptic. Some think it's pretty straightforward, just a political domination. But others are seeing things in there that don't quite make sense, that seem to be more than just political power and liberation. Then you have the Greco-Roman backdrop. It's interesting that in the Greco-Roman culture, you have what are called mystery religions, secret societies, secret religions. There are two major ones. One is the older Greek, and the other is a later Greco-Roman. The Eleusinian mysteries supposedly go back to the Mycenaean age, 1700 BC. But they were especially popular in the what's called the Archaic Era and the Classical Era, say 700 BC to about 500 BC or 450 BC. And it celebrated the goddess Demeter and the myth of Persephone. Do you guys know that myth at all? It's a celebration of spring and the cycles of the seasons. The myth is that Demeter, the goddess, loses her daughter, Persephone, to the uncle, Hades. And Persephone gets pulled down into the underworld. And that time is when Demeter goes into a period of depression. Demeter was the goddess of agriculture. And so when Persephone is pulled into Hades, into the underworld, into hell, Sheol, the place of the dead, with her uncle, Demeter goes into depression, and that's what? Winter. But then a deal's cut, and Persephone is allowed to come back up every year for anywhere from 6 to 8 months, and that is the birth of spring. And so that spring rebirth of life all around is Demeter expressing her joy, getting over her depression. And in the Eleusinian Mysteries, we're not exactly sure all that they did in these things. That's why they're called mysteries. They didn't write this stuff down. A lot of the information we get is from secondary sources and then studying icons on the inside of these places where they would worship the symbols. We don't know a lot about it, but there are some interesting things that we've found about them, and I'm going to go over some of that. Plato, who comes after this time, picks up on some of this. Plato talks about the Eleusinian Mystery. Aristotle talks about it as well. And Plato seems to be pulling in some of these ideas in his famous cave metaphor. Have you ever read this? This is the cave, and he describes these prisoners. They're looking at this wall, and then behind them is this wall with images, say, of person. And then you have the sun outside the cave, and you have a fire here. And the fire is showing light on the image, which casts a shadow onto the wall. And these guys are described as bound. They're bound in position. They can't move. They can't turn. And their heads are fixed on the wall. And all they're seeing are shadows. And they think the shadows are the real things. And so they're sitting there talking about the shadows and explaining what they are and what their meaning is and so on. And some of them are boasting that they have a better understanding of the shadows than others. But Plato's point is that truth is up here. And he talks about different levels of understanding. Understanding the shadow is the lowest level. Understanding the things that are casting their image onto the wall is the next level. And you keep on going up. You're ascending. He talks about going up the cave. You're ascending towards the light. And the sun is the ultimate source. And he says, what needs to happen, this is the average man here, bound, looking at the shadows. What needs to happen is the philosopher needs to come down and break this guy's bonds and turn his head. And the word there for turning is conversion. It's a conversion experience. And the conversion is from darkness and shadow into light and substance. The substance. And it's a progress. You're going up, 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 making progress towards light. And Plato's kind of cryptic about this, about the identity of the sun, but many scholars have argued that the sun represents God. And it's an ascent into the knowledge of God, of the divine. And this image is picked up by the Roman mystery religion called the Mithraic religion. They would actually meet in caves. And they would... The position of the caves would be to where you go down into the caves. Oftentimes they would be buildings with a big basement, special basement. And only those who were initiated into the mystery could actually go in. And they would celebrate using different rituals. I'll talk about them momentarily. But the idea was, following Plato's image, those who are in the mystery are celebrating and experiencing this progressive move towards the light. Mithras was a divine hero. And there are different understandings of who he was. Some said he was identified with the sun god Helios, the Greek sun god Helios, the sun. But most scholars that I've read think that the Mithraic mystery comes from the Persian religion of Zoroastrianism. And that religion believed that the world was split into two ultimate principles of good and bad. And the god who was good is referred to as the god of light. Ahura Mazda is his name. The god of light, of justice, of goodness, of wisdom. He's called the eternal god. And then there's a wicked god, his archenemy, that he's at war with. And Ahura Mazda sends spirits to go to war with this god. And Mithras, if this is true, if the Roman religion, Roman mystery religion comes from that, would be either equivalent to someone like Ahura Mazda or a messenger sent from Ahura Mazda. He was a warrior figure, and he fought on the side of goodness and truth, light. And this mystery religion was most attracted to the Roman soldiers because he was himself a soldier. Mithras was a soldier. And a number of scholars I read said that this probably originated in Asia Minor. It was very, very popular in Cilicia. What town was in Cilicia that you know of from the Bible?
Tarsus.
Paul's hometown in Tarsus. They were everywhere. These mystery religions were everywhere throughout Asia Minor and really throughout the Mediterranean. We know that part of the celebration involved this idea that you were dying to an old life and being raised again to a new life. This is where the Eleusinian mystery comes in. With the celebration of rebirth in nature, think about the seed, what a seed is. A seed first comes into existence as a living thing, right? A grain, it's alive. But it has the potential to really turn into something magnificent and to flourish into a whole other kind of life. But in order for that to happen, what must occur first? It has to be killed, as it were. It has to be buried. It has to die and be buried. And in the Eleusinian mysteries, we're told that Plutarch, I think, is the one that tells us that they would sit silently with a grain, just one single grain, and they would hold it as a symbol of what they were all experiencing, a death to old life and an initiation to a new life. And they actually used the phrase rebirth, that they were undergoing rebirth. They were being reborn. There's an interesting connection here. Plutarch makes this point. He says, the Greek word for the initiate, the person who was initiated into the mystery, was telestai. What word do you recognize in this?
Telios.
Yeah. Yeah. End, goal, purpose. It's also often translated as perfected, mature, the mature, the perfected. This is used by Paul frequently. He talks about that. English translators go back and forth about whether to use mature or perfected. But Plutarch notes that the verb form for to die is very similar. And he suggested that the idea was to be initiated was to die. And to be initiated was to be set on a path towards his higher goal of new life. Okay? They also celebrated a sacred meal. It was a secret society. No one was allowed in unless you were initiated. And those who were involved partook of a sacred meal. And it involved breaking bread. It involved, in many cases, drinking either a cup of water or of wine. But it was an experience of death and new life. That was the idea. They're partaking, in some cases, they described it as partaking of the divine nature. For many of them, the new life, the higher life, came by actually absorbing or partaking in the divine nature. That was the idea. And they had different means of trying to do this. In some of the mystery religions, they actually used hallucinogenic drugs, and the belief was that they would experience God through some non-cognitive means. In one inscription that was found, it talks about how in this mystery religion, they met what were called Mithraeon, which were the caves were called the Mithraeon. And in one place, there's an inscription which says that they prayed that the Lord of the air would indwell them. The Lord of the air, they prayed for the Lord of the air to indwell them, to come into them. So somehow they're absorbing the divine. And Plato describes this on a more intellectual level. He says the closer you get to a knowledge of the good, which is pictured as the sun, the more you're experiencing the divine, this absorption of the divine into yourself. There's also, in the Mithraic mystery religion, a belief in the saving power of blood. Many of the pictures in the caves showed Mithras killing a bull, and the bull shedding his blood. And there are inscriptions saying that the blood shed by Mithras saves us. So scholars are not quite sure how they understood the shedding of the blood, but it had a salvific effect for some of them. So let me summarize some of these themes. This is going to be part of what you want to look for when you go in and you look at Paul's use of mysterion, mystery. I have seven things here. First of all, they believed that through the mystery religion, there was a higher, better form of life to live than what was offered in the public religions. See, the mystery religions were put in contrast to the public, official Greek and Roman religions, which were state religions. Only a minority people were involved. Secondly, they believed that this higher, better way of life came through a union with the divine. And the union was described in different ways, as an intellectual ascent to the divine, as a mystical absorption into the divine, as the divine somehow indwelling you. They all describe this as a conversion. Number three, it was understood as a conversion, a turning. And they described it as a turning from darkness to light and from death to life. Number five, they all thought that this conversion was to be followed by a progression in enlightenment, in the spiritual maturity. In fact, in the Mithraic mystery religion, there were grades of spirituality. I think there were four, six, I can't remember. But the idea was you're ascending to these new levels of spiritual maturity, of insight, of enlightenment. So there's progress going on. You don't just get initiated and then stay at this flat line. You're initiated to grow, to progress. And that this enlightenment, this progression would make a difference. It's going to bring them fulfillment. This is one of the interesting things that scholars will all say about the mystery religions. In contrast to the official state religions, which were just outward dead rituals, the idea was that in the mystery religions, something's happening to you. Your life is getting changed somehow. You're having an experience. You're undergoing some sort of deep fulfillment, some insight, something that's making a difference. And it was intensely emotional and meaningful to them. And during the Hellenistic period, when these things really started to blossom, there was widespread confusion because of the conquest of Alexander, and there was a breakdown of the official state religions, and there was this quest to find some spiritual significance, and so the mystery religions became very popular. But the idea was you're experiencing a personal salvation, a personal transformation somehow. And then finally, this was supposed to occur, number 7, within the context of a community, a sacred, secret community. These groups were relatively small. They had an egalitarian tendency. They shared things. And this new life, this new experience was supposed to occur just there. You don't share this experience with those outside. That's why it's called a mystery religion, the mysterion. It's a secret. Your mouth is kept closed. You don't share it with anyone. And the only way, if you want to know what this is like, if you want to experience this new life, if you want to experience this transformation, you have to get what? Initiated. You have to convert. And you only experience it in the privacy of the cave. You only experience it in the privacy of these meetings. But it would occur in the context of these communities. They would share a sacred meal. There were rituals. There were what were called symbola or symbols. There were formulas that were uttered. Okay? So that's the Greco-Roman background. And I'm sure all of you have already seen connections, many connections, with what you know of the New Testament. But what I'd encourage you to do is go into the New Testament, look up those 27 references to mysterion. I can tell you right now that about, I think, 4 or 5 of them are not as relevant. But go in and look them up and go into the context and look at the language in the context and notice how Paul is pulling from the Jewish framework and the Greco-Roman framework. And he's saying that Christ is pulling all of those ideas, those ideals, those motifs, he's pulling them all together in himself. And he is the truth. He's that which has been kept secret, that which men are longing for, that which men are trying to find through these mysteries. So that's your homework assignment. And the hint here is that there's a progression. You're going to find a progression. Jesus begins to disclose the mystery. He just begins to disclose it. He does not disclose it entirely. And he even says this, you'll find. It's only with the apostles that the mysterion is fully disclosed. And you'll see why as you get into the text. And yet, it's also something that we are to continue to penetrate. You're going to see it's been fully disclosed. It's been laid out before us. But now there's something that we have to do to go in and start probing the depths of it, to penetrating it. And there's a duty to do so. There's a need to do so. And there's a great, great benefit in doing so. And I think if we understand this idea of the great mystery that's revealed to us in Christ, we will get more excited about getting into the Word and using our minds. Any questions? It's 10:30.
I make a totally pagan observation on this. In reality, you know, the Greco-Roman thinking and all these secret initiations and things like that progressed to a point where it influenced the Jews. And then, you know, it kept progressing to that point.
Yeah.
Blood
Are you suggesting that, not that you believe this, but you're just playing devil's advocate and suggesting that Christianity is just a ripoff of these?
Yep.
Oh yeah, that's the standard view among academics.
Yep.
It's the standard view that Christianity is just a new form of the mystery, Greco-Roman mystery religions.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. See, let me share a personal testimony on this. I used to think that the support for the truth of the New Testament message would be increased according to the degree to which it's independent of influences from without. And that was part of my fundamentalist Bible training. And I gradually started to see that it's just the reverse. That if Christianity is true, it makes all the sense in the world that God is preparing the stage, working behind the scenes, setting the conditions conceptually, linguistically, philosophically, for Christ to take on maximum meaning to the human mind. And so I see this as a strong argument for Christianity. And I'm not just saying that because it's pretty convenient to do so. I'm saying that because it makes sense. It makes sense that if Christianity is true, if Christ is God incarnate who is reconciling the whole world to himself, and if he has been setting this up through shadows and type, then you would expect shadows and type to be everywhere. And like I said in a previous lesson, if this is the cross, we're in first century, it's not that you have Old Testament Hebrew going straight to it without mixture with Greek, which would be, say, we'll say Greco-Roman, i.e. pagan. That's not an accurate view. The accurate view would be more like that. When does Greek culture start to infest Israel? And even really before that, we know that Greek coins have been excavated all throughout Palestine that go back to the 6th, 7th century BC, so long before Alexander. So they had interaction with Greek culture long before Alexander. But with Alexander, with Hellenization, you have 300 years to where Greek culture is right smack dab dropped next to you. They had gymnasiums in Israel in the 3rd century BC. They had Greek gymnasiums in Israel. That amphitheaters, right? I mean, so 300 years of synthesis. Apollos was probably the greatest mind of the first century church. Trained in Alexandria, trained in all the wisdom of the Greeks and the Old Testament. The Septuagint was the Old Testament in what? Greek. That's what many of them read. This idea that there was this sort of this pure line of Hebraic, Judaic thinking going straight to the cross, and that the New Testament authors are just pulling from that, is so misleading. These guys are operating in a synthetic culture. Yeah.
But things like blood and meal, etc., were in fact revealed. synthesis began, mm-hmm. so that there could have been, you know, a trickling effect of synthesis on the Egyptian, Greco-Roman, Babylonian, whatever.
Oh yeah.
You know, way before that.
Yeah, you have mystery religions in Egypt.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, and I don't mean to suggest at all that those seven motifs that we went down are exclusive to the Greco-Roman mind. You see many of them in the Jewish mind. But the point is that you don't have to know Judaism to make sense of a lot of the spiritual truths that are ours in Christ. Yeah.
One thing to say that Christianity borrowed, but it's another thing to see Paul and Jesus as drawing from the culture points of connection. For instance, Paul saying the mystery of Christ, well, yeah, he's connecting with their understanding mm-hmm. of mystery, Greek mystery, mm-hmm. Greek mystery religions, and saying, no, this is the true mystery.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's just a whole different way of looking at it. And like you said a few minutes ago, it would make sense that he would do that. They would, we would do the same thing today. If the gospel had been mm-hmm. first revealed in this culture, it would look different in terms of the terminology, the images that would be, mm-hmm. I think, drawn on to illustrate it.
Yeah. And when you go in to do your homework assignment this week, if you look carefully at the language in those contexts where Paul talks about the mystery that's been revealed to us, he is using the language that would have resonated immediately with the Greco-Roman mind, uninitiated in Judaism. But look at the different content that's poured into it. See, he's going to pour different content. It's, in a sense, old wineskins, new wine. It's similar form, similar linguistic and conceptual imagery, but a different content. And he's actually going to exploit, if you read Paul carefully in light of what we've talked about, Paul's going to exploit the failures and the emptiness of the Greek mystery religions. He's going to say, you guys are on to something, but you don't have the substance. You still don't have the substance. And he's going to pour in the substance, show them. And there's some real ironic twists and turns in Paul's interaction with these churches. And keep one more thing in mind, then we'll close. The two epistles that are going to be most relevant to the study will be Ephesians and Colossians. And if you think about where they were located, they were smack dab in the heart of this Mithraic mystery religion context and really the entire framework that we've talked about. People that were reading Paul's letters would have converted. Many of them would have converted from those mystery religions. And Paul knew that. He lived in Ephesus for 2 years. So I think it's exciting. It's really, really exciting stuff. And it makes the Word of God come to life when you understand it from that background. Tom, would you close for us in prayer, please?